Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It's 9:00 AM on February 20th, 2024. Time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. To my right is Tony Olson, our Vice President. To my left is Rebecca Wolf, our Secretary. Have with us today John Harlow, our CEO General Manager, Colin Willenbrock, our General Counsel, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or electronic devices at this time. This session is for the Board and CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. Are there any items to be added or changes to make to the published agenda, Commissioners?
Yes, item 1A2, other, add at places Everett to Delta 115 kilovolt transmission line.
Thank you. Okay, first up is our item, agenda item number one, our CEO General Manager briefing. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Commissioners. Everybody had a nice long weekend. We have lots of good stuff on the agenda this morning, so we'll get right at it. First up is our legislative update and Ryan Collins. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Ryan Collins, the District State Government and External Affairs Specialist 3, and I'm here to present on our key legislation report covering the first 2 weeks of February and the 2024 session. The purpose of this presentation is to report on legislation we've identified as key state legislation for the Commission. While I've left time at the end of this presentation for any questions the Commission may have, please feel free to jump in at any time as well. Today, February 20th, marks the day 44 of the 60-day legislative session. When looking back at the past 2 weeks, you can observe that several cutoff dates have passed. On Tuesday, February 13th, the legislature reached a milestone, the deadline to pass bills off the floor of the House of Origin. Lawmakers worked several late nights and over the weekend to pass as many bills as they could prior to the cutoff. Bills that did not meet the deadline are considered dead and are ineligible to move forward this year unless considered necessary to implement the budget or NTIB. It is important to note that bills are never truly dead because their contents can be amended into other legislation or rare procedures can be moved and can occur to keep them alive. On Wednesday, February 14th, the focus of the legislature shifted back to the committees. Bills are assigned again to committees that have the same type of work sessions, public hearings, and debate as their original chamber. The next legislative deadline is February 21st, tomorrow, in which all bills must pass out of their policy committees to remain alive. Today, we will walk through 8 bills that we have identified as key legislation. You will notice that we've removed 2 bills from the February 6th report, HB 2253, the Community Solar Bill, and SB 6206, the Failing Water Receivership Bill, because they failed to advance beyond their policy cutoff. The other 6 bills continue to move forward through the legislative process with several slated for hearings this week. As we look ahead to the next couple of weeks, the legislative pace is quickening with the next policy cutoff, as I said, tomorrow. It's hard to believe, but sine die is just 3 short weeks away, and we only have 1 more key legislative report before concluding the 2024 session. I will start off with HB 1955, a bill that would repeal the greenhouse gas content disclosure provision within the Energy Transformation Act, also known as CETA. As a reminder, this bill repeals duplicative reporting requirements. The bill remains non-controversial, and the legislative text has not been amended since it was first introduced. Under this legislation, Snohomish PUD would still report its GHG emissions, but to only 1 agency, the Department of Ecology. The bill has moved swiftly through the process and received a hearing in the Senate Environment, Energy, and Technology Committee last week on February 14th with no public opposition. It is supported by a wide swath of stakeholders, and Snohomish PUD expressed its support during the hearing on February 14th as well. We anticipate this bill moving forward pretty quickly. Next is HB 1589, or supporting Washington's clean energy economy and transitioning to a clean, affordable, and reliable energy future. As a reminder, this bill was brought to the legislature by Puget Sound Energy, also known as PSE, and aims to set them on a path to ease out of the retail natural gas business. Since my last report, the House version of the bill emerged as the vehicle for this policy change, therefore the Senate bill will no longer advance. The legislation continues to undergo significant revisions to address the various concerns raised by stakeholders. The ongoing saga of passing HB 1589 exemplifies the acute challenges facing the state's largest utility and advocates who support the transition to cleaner energy. For example, a key provision that existed as introduced stipulated an almost immediate timeline for PSE to stop connecting new customers to natural gas. The current version no longer includes that provision. What remains of the bill is mostly setting up a regulatory framework for PSE to phase out of natural gas rather than an immediate stop. Key provisions to highlight include the creation of a single integrated service plan or ISP for PSE, which would allow them to plan for both electrical and gas in one plan. The plan would also include items like emissions targets, clean energy action plan, implementation strategies, and low-income electrification. Additionally, it includes a prohibition on PSE's offering of incentives for residential gas customers starting in 2025 and commercial and industrial customers in 2031. Lastly, the amended language includes a requirement for PSE to coordinate with consumer-owned utilities like the PUC that have dual service areas with PSE, should PSE plan to phase out natural gas in that area. This language explicitly outlines how PSE must conduct outreach to impacted COUs in their ISP, including targeted electrification, and provide data for assessing the impact on new load capacity and electric distribution on a COU. Since these outreach plans must be included in the submitted ISP, which is then approved by the Utility and Transportation Commission, UTC, affected utilities also have an available and public process to engage in if anything should arise. The bill is continuing to move forward in the process and was amended and voted out of the Senate Environment, Energy, and Technology Committee on February 16th. We will continue to monitor and review the legislation, which will continue to evolve as it moves forward. I want to pause there because I also want to give Marion Dock, our contract lobbyist, a chance, if she has any comments on this bill, to chime in now.
No comments. You handled it well. Thanks, Brian.
Perfect. All right. Next is HB 2082, which would direct the Washington State Department of Commerce to conduct a study on the employment and workforce needs of the electrical transmission industry in Washington. This bill did not make it past its fiscal cutoff on February 5th. However, we understand there are ongoing conversations about funding the study at the heart of this bill through a budget proviso. In fact, as I was reviewing the operations budget for the House yesterday, I noticed that it was included in there, so we'll continue to monitor that as it goes forward. This is a perfect example of, again, how bills can be amended or changed into different things as they move forward in the process. Questions? Next is HB 2156 and its Senate companion SB 6256, which it improves consumer protections on solar installations. This bill has not changed since they were passed out of their respective policy committees. The legislation continues to provide details on licensing and contract requirements for solar installations in Washington. As a reminder, this bill underwent strong stakeholder engagement and has generally been non-controversial in committee hearings. In my last report, Commissioner Wolf asked if requiring all solar installers to be licensed electrical contractors was a new requirement. And under current RCW, anyone who is installing or maintaining electrical equipment needs to hold a valid electrical license. While solar installers should be covered under the broader definition and statute, HB 2156 and SB 6256 explicitly require anyone installing, repairing, or maintaining solar systems must have a valid electrical license or be a licensed design professional practicing in their specific field of training to work on any systems over $1,000. Again, this bill continues to move forward in the legislative process and was voted out of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee on February 15th, and actually on the House side has a hearing scheduled today.
Right. Yeah, can we go back to this?
Sure.
So does this impact how solar is marketed to customers? I've seen, I swear, in the last 2 months, a plethora of what looks like very deceptive solar ads targeted at residents in Washington.
Yeah, so part of the two kind of key components of this bill are, one, the licensing requirement and making sure that any solar contractor, again, has electrical licensing. But then on top of that is a standardized contract that specifies specific sales practices and things that need to be included in a contract going forward to exactly get at this, these kind of deceptive sales practices that you're not going to have any energy bill going forward, all of these things. So the Department of Commerce brought this bill forward first, namely because they've got Big Solar for All grant, the federal government coming due this summer. And with the influx of federal dollars coming in, they're concerned about these types of deceptive sales practices proliferating.
No problem.
Then Commissioner, would that reduce the opportunity? When you mentioned that, I had two folks, friends, call me from Lake Stevens or so ago, and there were two or three gentlemen in their neighborhoods. And they were saying the PUD was going to increase their rates by 42%. And seeking a contract with the customer to install solar, and they had, so would the fact that they have to be licensed under this legislation, it might help them. I would ask if someone I was going to hire.
I guess that's my concern, if the information they're putting out accurate, it makes us the bad guy.
Well, I just.
They actually put your assistant here.
Perhaps it's my.
My guess is the folks that are soliciting residents are not the licensed electricians that are doing the installing. They're just the marketing and the sales folks. So it probably would have no impact in proving what they are able to say or how they can sell that solar system.
I will comment that were this bill to pass, part of the contract that solar installers present to customers does have a specific rate that the utility would be paying for their generation of the solar installers. So while they may be able to market it incorrectly, the contract itself has to be valid and accurate.
So they have to use our current rates?
Correct, yes.
Oh, okay. So that's a big advantage.
Yeah.
Yeah, doesn't utilities still have the roster of approved solar contractors?
Yeah, solar installers?
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay.
Great. Hearing no more, move on to the next. Next is SB 6058, which would amend Washington's statute to allow the Department of Ecology to link Washington's carbon markets with California and Quebec's. I'll quickly note that the Senate version will be the vehicle for this policy, as such the House bill is no longer advancing. This bill has seen several iterations since it was first introduced due to the technical and complex nature. It's fair to say that the legislature and the Department of Ecology are interested in getting the details right and have been hard at work modifying the bill in relation to impacted stakeholders. At a high level, the bill would align Washington's statute to better ensure compatibility between Washington's carbon market and those of California and Quebec. To do so, the bill includes technical adjustments that would harmonize these three carbon markets by standardizing rules and procedures for trading and market coordination. It would also establish consistent reporting standards as well as help connect the necessary infrastructure for linking each jurisdiction's auctions, allowances, and emissions data. New amendments over the past couple of weeks have included changes sought by the utility industry, including the definition of wheeled electricity and changes to reporting requirements for small utilities. On the definition of wheeled electricity, this definition was added to the bill to ensure clarity on how to deal with electricity that is generated outside of the state and gets wheeled through Washington but is never delivered here. The inclusion of this definition should limit the potential for market friction while increasing trading efficiencies and lowering program costs for the PUD. Importantly, the bill now includes provisions that would remove roadblocks for the Bonneville Power Administration to voluntarily participate in the Climate Commitment Act, the Climate Commitment Act's carbon program, which would reduce compliance obligations associated with unspecified resources inherent in BPA's power. This change would help the PUD's ratepayers if BPA chooses to opt into the program. Theoretically, linking Washington's carbon markets with California and Quebec should benefit all Washington ratepayers by lowering allowance prices, providing additional price predictability and stability, and further incentivizing emissions reduction strategies. The bill received a hearing in the House Environment and Energy Committee with utility voices supporting the legislation, and we plan on expressing our support when the bill moves to its respective fiscal committee. Despite strong stakeholder support, the passage of this bill is not assured due to the complexities of Initiative 2117, which would repeal the CCA and will be on November's ballot.
So I believe, and I could be wrong, that when we're using RECs, we can only use RECs that come, I think, from the Pacific Northwest or from our state, we can't use like Rex from Texas. Is there any move foot to broaden the market for Rex since now it's okay to purchase carbon offsets from Quebec?
So I'll look to phone a friend on at least the sharing of Rex. I know at least the idea of linkages is that you should be able to buy allowances, carbon allowances within California and Quebec. Rex, if I'm understanding your question right, could also be a little different than the allowances that the CCA specifies. But I'll let Garrison throw in.
Before you speak to the people who are on Zoom, we should define renewable energy credits because not everybody knows what RECs are.
Correct.
It'd be like, you know.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks, Ryan. Garrison Morris, Senior Manager of Power Supply. And it's a great question. A lot of our reporting for regulatory compliance includes sort of our attribution of the resources that we use and then also the carbon associated with that. As one example, our fuel mix reporting, right? It includes all of the resources that we use for I-937 compliance, which does include those RECs. And then that also gets used for our greenhouse gas reporting. So they do seem like they overlap, but I-937 is a separate section of law. And so while this is taking a look at the Climate Commitment Act portion of the law, I-937 remains untouched. And so it does have to be in that Pacific Northwest catchment area to be an I-937 or Energy Independence Act eligible REC for renewable compliance there.
Yeah, and that's what I had understood. I guess I'm just wondering if the legislature is looking at the logic of opening up, allowing us to use RECs from other places. I mean, carbon is carbon, right? Wherever it's emitted in the world, so. Yeah, the logic of using Quebec, which is logical to me, it just seems logical that we could buy REC from Texas or wherever.
Yeah. So the way that these laws have been passed, obviously there is some overlap between the different proposals, and I think the state is in the process of one now that there's been about a year of setting up the Climate Commitment Act and the carbon markets. Understanding where those frictions exactly, like where what are RECs, what compared to no cost allowances within the CCA, what can be traded, what can't be. And so the idea again behind this bill is to again expand at least one of those markets to use. And I think again the legislature is always looking for other ways to improve these markets.
The motivation behind the Energy Independence Act was to promote more renewables in the Northwest.
Correct.
And especially in Washington.
Correct, yes. So, RECs are primarily used for generation capacity, whereas the CCA is specifically on carbon emissions. Again, measuring different things, although getting kind of at the same intent behind moving and transitioning us to a cleaner future. All right, into the final rounds here. Next is HB 1391, which would direct the Department of Commerce to set up a third-party energy efficiency navigator program to administer outreach and provide education on energy efficiency rebates and available to Washington households. This bill has been quietly moving through the process and hasn't seen any changes since it was first reintroduced. The bill would benefit PUD customers interested in upgrading their homes with more energy efficiency appliances by providing program information and eligibility for available federal, state, and local incentives. At the time of submitting this report, the bill had not received a public hearing, but is scheduled for one soon. It also was listed in the budgets this year, so we could also again see this bill transition to a budget proviso as opposed to legislation.
Sure takes a long time to get something. This, I remember last year, this was in the works, and I was hoping, hurry, hurry.
Yeah.
But it's like most legislation, it takes a long.
It takes a while, particularly to properly vet and stakeholder it with the various entities that are impacted. But you're absolutely right. I think everybody is generally aligned in terms of wanting to get this information out. Next is HB 2199, which I'm actually speaking to for the first time, even though it was included in the last report. This bill would create a B&O tax and public utility tax exemption for entities that are required to engage in the Climate Commitment Act carbon markets. Under the CCA, covered entities are required to purchase or are provided at no cost carbon allowances to cover carbon emissions. It was never the intent of the CCA to have a sale of those allowances taxed. This bill would modify Washington statute to address that unintended consequence. The bill was voted off the House floor with an amendment that restricted speculators from receiving this exemption. This remains a non-controversial bill that is supported by the utility industry. We indicated our support during the testimony on February 16th, and we anticipate this bill to move forward.
I would like to know what no-cost allowances are.
Yes.
What are some examples?
So the no-cost allowances are actually something we were just talking about. They're the allowances for a, I believe the measurement is a metric ton of carbon dioxide emitted. These are the compliance mechanisms inherent in the CCA to cover your emissions targets, and will slowly ramp down over time as kind of the incentive to decreasing your emissions. No problem. Last but not least is the now dead SB 6304, which would have implemented several of the recommendations provided by the state's transportation electrification strategy. I won't spend too much time on this bill since it's technically dead, but I do want to give the commission more context for it to be revived. As background, the state's TES was a document produced by the Washington State Electric Vehicle Council, which was mandated by the Move Forward Washington law to develop it. After more than a year of stakeholder engagement, the EV Council issued a final TES in November of 2023, which included a long list of policy recommendations needed to decarbonize the transportation sector. This bill would codify several of those recommendations. The major recommendations include defining how the state should manage electric vehicle charging installation and inventory. It would also allow for the sale of sale of zero emission vehicles direct to consumers, as well as specify requirements for medium and heavy duty vehicles. As I mentioned earlier, this bill could be considered necessary to implement the budget and could be revived. If it is, it will likely be as a very different version than the one we're updating you on right now. We are currently continuing to analyze how this legislation may impact PUD operations, and I will make sure to update the commission if it does come back up.
This is a high priority of the governor, isn't
it? They are currently tracking it. It's Senator Leas, who represents the Edmonds area, is the main sponsor and is kind of the big push behind it. The TES is a big priority of the governor. Before I end, I wanted to give the commission a heads up and to expect updates on the supplemental budget in my next report. Legislative budgets, as I mentioned, were just released at the beginning of this week, and we're currently sifting through them. As I mentioned earlier, we identified the transmission workforce study in the House operations budget, but there will likely be additional provisos to make the commission aware of. Lastly, I wanted to update the commission that all six initiatives that were submitted to the Secretary of State were verified and transmitted to the legislature for further consideration in a vote on the November ballot. As a reminder, the legislature can pass these initiatives, consider an alternative to each one, or ignore them all individually or all together. If the legislature considers an alternative or ignores them, the initiatives and their alternative will then go to the voters on the November ballot. Needless to say, the final weeks of the 2024 legislative session will certainly be interesting. And with that, I'll see if there are any other questions.
I have
no. Thank you, Ryan. Oh, of course. Thank you, Ryan. No problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. Great job. Next up, in under other, we have Andrew Flaherty give us an update on the proposed effort to Delta 115 kV transmission line. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning. At all. My name is Andrew Flaherty. I'm the manager of Transmission and Standards Engineering. I'm here today to talk to you about the new Everett to Delta 15 kV line. A little bit of press lately, so you may hear a little bit about it. I've got Aziz Haq with me here today. He's the project lead here. So I'm going to start you off, and then he's going to come up and take over. Just as the purpose of this presentation is to inform you what's going on, give you a little bit of background, so if you get questions, you'll have an answer, but we're not expecting anything from you. A little bit of background for you, 2022-23, we're working on a transmission study for the transmission system. It kind of, low forecasts, things like that, we're finding that to the north, we are probably going to not be able to meet NERC requirements in the next decade or so if those loads come as we expect, as if they materialize. So it's kind of kicked off quite a few projects as we're moving forward here. So this is kind of the first of a wave. Right now we've got the three main feeds into our system from BPA, and we're going to be getting a fourth. This we're starting right now in Marysville. This line that we're talking about today kind of ties them together so that funds can flow to Marysville or from Marysville to Everett. This line will be required to be in compliance.
Are those pictures examples of the kinds of faults we're doing?
Yes. So these are just, we don't know exactly what the route is yet or the exact line and the exact poles, but these are just kind of stereotypical ones of what we're looking at. So our normal poles would be the ductile iron, which you see there on the left. And then if we go certain routes or if we have certain angles, things like that, we'll need an engineered pole, which would be the steel you see on the right. So here's a little project information for you. The new line will go between the Everett substation and the Delta substation. So Everett substation right over here, Delta is up kind of right where Broadway turns into 529. So it is a new 115 kV line. Started the route study last year. It's not done yet. So Aziz is going to talk a little bit more about that in a second here and kind of what we're looking at. We're going to get into design this year once a route is chosen, and then get into permitting and easements after that, and then construction hopefully 2027. So we're looking at expected route chosen hopefully next month. There's a few things up in the air still that could affect that. There might need to be a little more studying done. All of that's kind of juggled at this time. I'm gonna call Aziz up here. He knows everything you could possibly know about these proposed routes.
Good morning. My name is Aziz Hawk. I'm in transmission engineering. So as Andrew was mentioning, we have a consultant on board, Power Engineers. And they were hired last June to perform the route study. And we asked them to come up with four routes, route options. Those are displayed here as route A, B, C, and D. Route A, I'll just go through it real quick for everybody. Route A would take us essentially out of Everett Substation along McDougal, and then we would find our way to Broadway, and it would follow Broadway essentially all the way to Delta Switching Station. And Route B essentially follows Route A, but where it differentiates there is, you know, at Broadway, when it gets to 12th, it would head east to East Marine View Drive, and it would find its way to Delta Switching Station from there. Route C and D are residential routes. And those two both go through, so Route C would follow Cedar, turn right on 23rd to Summit, and then it would head up East Marine View Drive to Delta Switching Station. The difference with Route D is instead of turning on 23rd, it would follow Cedar all the way to 15th. And there's a couple jogs there in the line you can see in the picture there. I think that's 15th to Maple and then 9th to East Marine View Drive. So those are the four route options that were identified by the consultants, and those are the four that we shared with the public at the open house. So here's just a quick timeline of sort of the communication that was sent out to the different municipalities and kind of the key stakeholders. So in October, we sent letters out, or the consultants sent letters out to the City of Everett, WashDOT, and Sound Transit, just to kind of make them aware of this project and to get any feedback of projects they have in the future. From there, we submitted an application to the DOT to kind of start the communication with them. That was in November. And during that time, October, November, we had, you know, with this project being a high visibility project, we got corporate comm involved early on, government affairs involved. We had meetings with Brenda White, and just to kind of get the ball rolling so we can make sure we're checking all the boxes there. We did meet with the city of Everett in December to get more feedback from them. And then from there, we sent out postcards to the public on January 8th. And that postcard was just to make them aware of the project and to make them aware of the open house. And at that same time, we had a comment period that was on the website. And man, I was getting all sorts of feedback in my email inbox. So I think overall with the open house and my email, I had like maybe 100 comments. So it was a lot of feedback. The open house was on the 24th in this room, and the comment period closed on February 1st. But there were still comments trickling in through other avenues.
It's great that we have a public process. I know it can be those up here in blocks, but I'm curious, have we done this before for other transmission projects, or?
I can't speak to that. I mean, perhaps Andrew or Mark may know, but I think we have, at least for like the Stanwood project.
Okay. Good.
Yeah, the only one that I'm familiar with, and Jason may be able to speak to more distant past, but was on the Stanwood Camino Vine. And we met with the city of Stanwood and lots of different stakeholders in that process.
I guess they'd be having like a public open house and postcard, right? But that's the part I'm
I'm not sure. I don't actually remember.
I'm glad we did it. So
I don't think we did it, but
the more transparent we can be there.
Jason Ziskowski, Assistant General Manager of Facilities Generation, Power Rates and Transmission. So we did have an open house when we built the Granite Falls line. I remember that I was fairly new at the time and went and attended, and I set up booths around the room, and then folks came in and walked around and just learned about different aspects of the line at the different stations. I don't remember if we had an open house for the Stanwood line, but I'm betting we did. It's kind of been the standard approach.
Thanks, Jason. So yeah, I guess all that to say the open house was a huge success. I think there was a lot of feedback, sort of the same sort of setup here. We had boards and folks all huddled up around us asking questions. So it was great. And on that note, so some of the concerns and feedback we got from the customers, sort of the key ones there are those routes C and D through the residential neighborhoods. We had a lot of feedback about those. There was concern there. The route A on Broadway did seem like the overwhelming favorite amongst all the routes. There was questions about why routes on the west were not considered or not listed. And the answer to that is that that area was looked at, specifically West Marine View Drive. And then another question was the railroad BNSF right away. That was something that wasn't initially considered because of the cost of permitting with BNSF and the space there. Another key thing was a question that came up was the request to underground the 115 transmission line. That is a great question. It was a common theme for sure. As many of you know, it's not something the district does at this time. And it significantly increases the cost of the project. Typically a minimum of 10 times the cost.
Do we have any under, I mean, I know that distribution lines get undergrounded when local or get paid for it, subdivisions or cities, but do we have much underground transmission?
We have one small section of underground transmission. Predates my time. I don't have a lot of knowledge about it, but I know we have one small section.
And it's not very common.
Right, yeah. The other key question was the timing of the project. Customers were just wondering, a lot of them came in thinking this was happening sooner than later. And as Andrew mentioned, construction's not planned for 2027. So there's a little time there. And the construction would take, I'd say at least 6 months for a project of this magnitude through the city.
Commissioner, I have a question.
Yeah.
the cost of these different routes can vary significantly. So did that in any way play in terms of informing the customers?
It did not, not at the time.
So it's too early in the process.
Right. Okay. So as one of the deliverables for the route study is a cost estimate per route.
Okay.
So that is expected to come with the final route study draft.
Okay, thank you.
So the next steps for the project here for us is, like I said, we've had a ton of feedback, lots of comments. So we're going to review those comments. We're in the process of reviewing those comments with the consultants. And so we'll be taking that feedback heavily into consideration before, you know, selecting a route. And as you just touched on there, Commissioner, cost estimates are also going to be playing a role in the selection of the route. We're hoping to select the route by the end of next month. Unless the results are inconclusive and we need to go back to the, not necessarily back to the drawing board, but we need to take a step back and consider other routes. So if that's the case, we need to have a route selected no later than August so we can try and stay on schedule.
Relating to Commissioner Olson's question, it does seem that it would make a difference to our the people who own the PUD to know the comparative costs for other different routes. And you have those figures, but you just haven't, oh, not quite yet.
Not yet, yeah, but it is a deliverable for the route study. So we will have those costs.
It seems like that would have been, or would be a good thing to include in another open house or
sure.
some part of the process.
And having another open house is something we've had discussions about.
Yeah.
So that's, we could maybe do that.
Yeah, I think the cost of individual routes is,
yeah, that question did come up during the open house. Folks were asking that question. So.
Did you, another question. Did the folks have any comments about the fact that why through my neighborhood when it's supporting growth up north?
I think that question did come up maybe a handful of times.
Okay.
Yeah, so there was some concern there. And the answer to that was, you know, the line is really not just for the north, it's essentially for all of the districts. So
yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, if it's in front of their house, right, they're the ones seeing that immediate impact. But it does serve the greater good, if you will. The last step would be to, you know, for us, once we do select a route, is to reconnect with all those key stakeholders, you know, City of Everett, WashDOT, South Transit. Potentially another open house. So I think with that, are there any other questions?
Questions for Sean?
Yeah.
No. Can you go back to the map of the route?
Sure.
Good question. So I went out yesterday and drove the route just to see for myself. Understand. I don't normally look up when I'm driving.
Sure.
And it goes in blind everywhere. It's amazing where we have lines in all these different houses. But one of the things I noticed was a lot of transmission. And I'm wondering, do we ever double up transmission? Does it make sense to use, an existing corridor and new poles instead of having one set of transmission lines have two?
So we do double up on the same structure just because it kind of takes redundancy. We take an outage on one, we may
right.
take an outage on both. But we could put a line down the same corridor potentially if there's enough space or right away. In the city, there's not a lot of right away to work with.
Right.
To put lines across from one another.
Yeah, I'm just looking at some of the lines, and some of the lines are in places they're so tall, trees are so far away from them. I guess a car could hit a pole and take it out, and then we've lost some redundancy.
Sure.
Didn't you find though that through some of the residential area, the streets are pretty narrow?
Yeah, but we have poles and alleys that are even narrower, much narrower than streets. And I certainly can understand. I mean, I know some people think transmission lines are beautiful, and I've expressed so in our meetings. But I don't find them particularly attractive. But I can certainly understand the residents
absolutely.
Don't have any kind of line distribution or transmission line in their street being, you know, upset about the
No, those are, they were all valid concerns.
Yeah.
It's hard to argue with them on that note. So,
yeah.
You know, one of the key things we kept stressing in the open house was really early in the process.
Yeah.
They're not set in stone. That's why this feedback was so critical on those decisions. So.
And we use a consultant because this is, they have expertise we don't, or?
I think it's just so we can get another, a different set of eyes on
okay.
the project and to come up with routes. And then from there, you know, because we do have a say in the process, but it's nice to have a third party kind of come in and perform that in-depth analysis.
Yeah.
Any follow-up questions?
I was just wondering, it might be a question for, does NERC have any concern or interest in equity? Or is it just all the technicals? I mean, this is an equity issue for the people who say, oh, they don't have any over there because they've got, you know, it's a wealthy neighborhood. Or
I would say yes, but in general, NERC is leaving all that up to the utilities. And
yeah.
really are just the body that oversees right. compliance to the statutes for reliability and security of the bulk electric
That's
system.
That's what I thought, but thank you.
Commissioner Wilson, any follow-up questions?
No.
One more question?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very helpful.
Yeah, great job. Okay, next up is the City of Montlake Terrace Recreational Trail Easement in Marine Barnes. Good morning, Maureen.
Morning. Not that tall. This is a pretty feel-good one to me, so I'm kind of excited about it. This is to go ahead and hear about the new 25-year trail, interurban trail through the city of Montlake Terrace. So the purpose of the presentation is to inform the board of the proposed 25-year interurban trail easement with the city of Montlake Terrace, outline the primary terms of the easement, and answer any questions regarding the transaction. The new easement will be brought to commission for a public hearing and approval by resolution at the March 5th commission meeting. So just a little bit of background, and I know that you guys have heard this quite a bit, so I kind of cut it down a tad. The trail follows the Pacific Northwest Traction Company, which is PNT, which was the former interurban electric train corridor, which ran from Seattle to Everett from 1910 to about 1939 and spanned approximately 30 miles. When the district purchased the electrical system from Puget Sound Power and Light, the corridor had already been converted to a power line corridor. In the 90s, Snohomish County and the cities of Edmonds, Montlake Terrace, Linwood, and Everett built an approximate 12-mile pedestrian and bicycle trail that connected to the 12 miles that were going through King County, starting in the city of Seattle. That is called the interurban. So the trail agreement with the city of Montlake Terrace, in light of the many changes in the previous 25 to 30 years, it was essential for us to draft an updated interurban trail easement template to put in place when these easements were expiring. The easement with Montlake Terrace was executed in 1997 and it expired in 2022. Since prior to the expiration, we've been working with the city to get an updated agreement in place. And as I mentioned, I think one of the last times I was here, at that time we did offer extensions. City of Everett did do that. Snohomish County and City of Montlake Terrace opted not to. So this easement is really the product of some significant collaboration, cooperation, and compromise between the city and district staff. So again, the term is also going to be for 25 years. There can be no modifications or changes to the trail without district review and approval. Whereas the trail is the actual paved portion, going 5 feet on either side of the center line, the city will maintain all of that. And we will continue doing our regular maintenance that we do along there, along our larger portion of the corridor. But any debris from dumping, transient camping, any other activities outside of that footprint, we will split that 50-50 on the cleanup with the city of Montlake Terrace. The city will also pay any costs associated with warning signage, bollards, and or protective devices. The district will inspect and maintain any fencing or stormwater infrastructure that we have installed upon the property previously. The location of the trail or trail amenities is at the sole expense of the city of Mount Lake Terrace, with the district retaining the right to request relocation as needed for safety, reliability, and safety. So our next steps. City of Mount Lake Terrace City Council approved this easement already. I believe they went before their council February 1st, and then it was approved on February 8th. At the March 5th, 2024 meeting, we will ask that a public hearing be held, and then commissioners can vote upon the resolution. District staff have reviewed and approved the request, and the updated trail easements have been put in place for the city of Linwood, that was 2018, and Snohomish County, which was 2023. And here is the route and just a picture from the trail, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? You've been contacted by the Cascade Bicycle Group about their interest in trying to somehow cross that 104.
I have, and they're going to be having a walkthrough coming up, I believe, yeah. in March, and I'm going to try to go on that with them to help come up with some
right.
different
it's
ideas.
A wonderful group. I met with them in 20 degree weather for about an hour.
Yeah,
they're in January. It was on a Saturday. Anyway, it was a very good meeting and wonderful people to work with.
Yeah, they seem great. Thank you.
Yeah.
No question, just a comment. You're just checking these things off.
I know.
Is there something we don't know? Or are you?
No, I'm just.
Soon and
I'm excited.
You're trying to recall or...
Yeah, we're just finally getting to a point where we're getting these guys all done and put away, and they'll be good for 25 years.
Any follow-up questions?
I have read the board.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Maureen,
it is excited.
Yeah, right on to your next one.
The next one, and I'm afraid, I apologize in advance, you guys might get a little bit sick of hearing from me today. So this is for the surplus and sale of an easement to Zayo Group, LLC. They are a fiber optics company. The purpose of this presentation is to, of course, inform the board of an upcoming request to declare surplus a portion of district fee-owned property and allow real estate services to execute an easement with Zayo Group. I'd like to be able to answer any questions regarding this transaction, and we're looking to inform commission in preparation of holding the public hearing and vote via resolution at the March 5th commission meeting. Zayo Group is requesting a 1500 square foot underground easement for placement of a fiber optic cable and conduit. The easement is non-exclusive and no facilities whatsoever are going to be placed above ground. They will actually, well, the one thing, they'll put signage to identify where the buried cable location is. The installation will take approximately 1 week, and then they don't expect to even be out there much except potentially yearly to look at it for liability is my guess. They are offering $5,000 compensation for the easement, and it was appraised and actually came in a little bit under that. But we're up at $5,000, and that covers the cost of recording and some staff time. So the easement is located in Arlington, and it would be just to the east a bit would be where the airport is. So it kind of gives you a little bit. It's off of 3rd Avenue Northeast between 194th Street Northeast and 188th Street Northeast. The dimensions are 30 by 50 feet. The corridor, our corridor there is 50 feet across, so it's just 30 feet spanning the entire width of it. And it also is west and adjacent to the BNSF rail property. It just shows a little bit better where it actually is. So no district equipment, facilities, or access is going to be impacted. District staff have all reviewed and approved the request. We also, Real Estate Services, recommend approving this request. As I said, an appraisal was completed to determine fair market value. And we will be back on March 5th for a public hearing and vote. So, any questions on that one?
This is funny.
Any questions?
No, I have no questions. I like your slide.
Oh, thanks.
Mr. Olson, any questions? I have none. I guess just an observation that I can appreciate how expensive it is for an organization to lay cable along distance.
Yes.
With this is only 30 or 50 feet, depending which way they run it.
Correct. And so I believe it's coming across the railroad, probably going under, which I can only imagine what they're charging.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Maureen. Great job.
Thank you.
Next up, we have the East County Community Office property purchase update. Doug Wilson. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning. I'm Doug Wilson, principal engineer with the Facilities Department, and give Maureen a little bit of a break here and talk about the East County Community Office property purchase, although she's been heavily involved with this project also. The purpose of this presentation is informational. It's to review the community office program goals that we have, provide some information on due diligence findings on the property, discuss next steps. So there's no action needed at this time from the board, although we'll talk at the end of the slides about some of the future actions. So just wanted to start with project benefits. So the project benefits for the East County Community Office, it will complete our local office replacement program that began in 2012. And then over on the right, you can see a slide from the consolidation study in 2019. And that was when we went through and did an economic analysis and made the recommendation to combine the Arlington and Stanwood offices into the North County office. And at that same time, the recommendation was also to combine the Snohomish and Monroe offices into this East County office. And you can see the table there at the right, which was part of the economic analysis that showed that over 30 years of operations, the consolidation saves on the order of about $32 million. So there's some significant benefits to consolidation. And so one of the things that comes out of that, though, is that you need the office becomes a little bit larger than you're just doing a one-for-one replacement. So that meant that we needed to find a property that can accommodate that. And then we also would just list here, just reiterating that benefits to the community of the offices, the community offices, both essentially some amenities that they have, including public meeting space. We'll be including electric vehicle charging stations. And then we'll get into some details that are a little specific to this East County site. So this is the property that we're looking at. It is currently, it's about 34 acres. It contains actually three separate parcels. It's currently an airport. It's basically immediately adjacent to the county fairgrounds in Monroe. So Highway 2 is just to the south of the property. This evaluation of this property began in August of 2022. And we entered into a purchase and sale agreement at that time for $7.15 million. And originally we had a 90-day feasibility period, followed by the completion of that due diligence, 15 days to complete the sale. Began that effort in earnest, but there was some uncertainty that came about whether the use of the property as a district facility is allowed by the City of Monroe Zoning Code. And so that has resulted in a series of extensions that have gone on. We currently are looking at an August 22nd of this year to complete our feasibility study, which also then will include a development agreement. I'll speak a little bit to what the development agreement is and what the purpose of that is. And then the closing would happen by September 6th of 2024. And then just another bullet. So we mentioned that this is an airport. One of the things that we are hoping to do based on our timeline, our development timeline, is to continue to allow the airport to operate for a period of time to provide the pilots an opportunity to find a new home for their airplanes. A lot of the airports in this area have a waiting list for hangars, and so it's not something that they can just immediately move to a new facility.
So, excuse me.
Sure.
Who's going to manage that?
We will contract.
Like, what's going to happen? So if somebody wants to land there, who's going to say, okay, you may land there?
So it is currently a, it is a private but public use airport. So you do not need permission to, explicit permission to land at the airport currently. More questions? We'll move on to the site plan. Okay, so this is sort of an overall site plan. You can sort of see Highway 2 going through there. That's the Frylands area, so a little bit to the south, and just off to the right of the screen is the fairgrounds. You can see just below where our property will be is the parking area for the fairgrounds. And then that's 179th is that north-south road that we'll be on. And there's currently a signalized intersection right there at Highway 2. So that was one of the things we were looking for properties for this, is we were looking for a few things. One, it needed to be big enough to accommodate our needs. Highway 2 access was a big thing, and having particularly signalized. And then also because we're in the city of Monroe, this property is in the city of Monroe, we have access to water and sewer service.
Question.
Yes.
Using Highway 2?
Yes.
Hmm.
Sorry?
A lot of congestion there most of the time.
There is. So if you look back to a little bit small here, but you can sort of see the diagram at the right is sort of, it's called a heat map. And so what that does is it looks at drive time. You pick a location, so those are sort of our current service areas or office locations where crews respond out of, and it calculates essentially what is the drive time to various areas within there. And so one of the things that does, that heat map indicated we should be somewhere there between Snohomish and Monroe, and it included, it looked at both current drive time, but it also looked at projections. So it looked at growth in the county and what our drive time is going to be in the future. Certainly, one of the challenges for 2 weeks a year is going to be when the fair is going. It definitely will get more complicated or congested there. One of the benefits is that coming out of this site, you can go north on 179th and access Highway 2 through Roosevelt. So there is sort of a back way that you could utilize also for that. One of the other areas or benefits of this particular location is the access to Highway 522. So one of the, when we looked at growth, a lot of the growth in our county or expected growth is in the south end of the county, where our Linwood office is, and we were at capacity there. And so one of the options potentially is to allow us to serve some of that growth in the South County via 522, Bothell, et cetera.
Your capacity at the Linwood office?
So it was designed for four crews, as opposed to so the North County office.
Oh, bad planning on that. I'm sorry.
Yes.
And that's a super fun sell. You want to clean up on that site, so you don't want to go back there and dig.
You and I know too much about that.
Sorry about that. I don't
think it'll be a problem, but regarding congestion and activity, mm-hmm. there are a lot of other events. There are drag car races, there are concerts throughout the year, but we shouldn't. The drag car races can be a noisy.
Yes, yes. And I do hear as we are sort of working on our master plan for this site, the city of Monroe did mention that the Snohomish County Fairgrounds is going through a master planning exercise of the fairgrounds. And so we intend to reach out to them and sort of understand what their plans are and see if there's some, make sure that our plans are mesh with their plans.
That's great.
Your Council, are you finished with your question?
Yes.
So you'll see on this, so you mentioned this, the property is about 34 acres. Not all of that land is developable. So on this diagram, you sort of see the red line defines the property. And then you can see a the little symbols that look like grass. So that is all critical area in there. So there still is about 15 acres of property that is developable, and that is adequate for us. So that's what that site plan is. One of the things that surrounding critical area is actually owned by the city of Monroe, and they have an easement across this property, and they have a vision of creating a recreational and interpretational facility out in this area. And so there's potentially some opportunities for us to collaborate with them on that, and maybe set up something where our critical areas could be part of that. And then we'll talk a little bit about the parking. So this is a sort of just a zoom in on it. So on the right, you can see 179th. The office building is up front, and then there's a warehouse, the loading dock, various buildings and yard area. And then you can see the parking up there to the north. So some of that parking may also be utilized for as a shared amenity with the city as part of that plan, as well as that driveway would be shared for the public to get back to it. You'll see the dashed orange lines there. One of the other items that is on this property, Williams Pipeline, has a natural gas transmission line, and so that is the easement through the property. So part of, as we were citing, was not only not building on top of that or putting parking only, but also offsetting the buildings from that.
What is the oval shape
there? I should have covered that over. So that that is an existing facility that will be removed. It was a racetrack, a go-kart racetrack.
Oh, okay.
That the previous owner built for his sons.
I just want to make sure we're putting a pool in there.
There is actually a pool associated with the residence, but we will be eliminating that or removing that.
This is going to serve all the way up to the far east of our district.
Correct. This is essentially going to combine the Snohomish Cruise and the Monroe Cruise into a single facility.
I have a question. Do we are we planning for customer walk-in?
Doug can speak to this better than I, but I think we anticipate the facility looking very similar to the North County.
Yeah, but in terms of access.
Yeah, so there will be, I mean, there's a variety of different sort of, you know, there's the CSR front line. Which,
no, I understand that, but in terms of the location, is it easy access for customers?
Yes, it should be, right? So if we go back here, you've got Highway 2, you've got the traffic light there at 179th, so it's a...
Okay.
So you basically would come up and right there. All right, I alluded to the development agreement previously, so there's a lot of words here, but essentially a development agreement is a legally binding agreement that vests the district's project to the city's development codes that are in place at the time. And what this does is it provides the district, both the district and the city, with certainty regarding how the property will be developed. What we don't want to do is purchase a property with certain intentions, and then regulations change and we can no longer develop on that property. So the development agreement is the mechanism that provides us with that certainty. The maximum duration of that agreement is 10 years by state law. The agreement, the way that the process works, is city staff and district staff work together to develop that document, and eventually associated legal departments also review it, but then ultimately it is reviewed and has to be approved by both the Monroe City Council and our commission. And because of the cost associated with the property, we have made clear to the seller that we want to have the development agreement in place prior to closing on the property. It's the way, in order to mitigate our risk associated. So here's sort of the next steps. So February through about July, we still are continuing to do additional due diligence and feasibility studies. I spoke a lot about the sort of the development agreement, but there are geotechnical investigations, some soil contamination questions that we're working through. as well as traffic impact studies. There's a whole list of studies and reports that are involved in doing that. In parallel with that, we'll be working to draft that development agreement with the city. And then we're shooting for the June and July timeframe is when it would go to Monroe City Council. They have a similar process where it'll be presented to them in one meeting, and then in a following meeting, they would actually vote on it. And then after they have gone through that, we would come to you, and again, sort of the two-step process. So in July, August timeframe, we would be looking to have you review and approve that development agreement as well as the property purchase. And that gets us to August 22nd to complete our due diligence with the sale by September 6th. Any questions?
Well, I appreciate all your work on this. It seems like it would be a really good site for us.
Yeah, we are excited about it, and we're excited. I understand you're going to be coming up to North County on Friday for a tour. We're using the North County as sort of the template for the design of East County in a lot of ways. So it'll give you an even better picture of what it is we envision doing up at East County.
I want to make sure I understood. You were talking about continued use of the airport.
Correct.
Does that entail the sale or the purchase, or is that before construction, or?
That would be post-sale, but prior to construction.
Okay.
Yes.
Is there any risk associated with that we're assuming?
That was a good question.
Now we're operating an airport.
Yes. And we did reach out to risk management when we were first looking at this and sort of said, hey, we're looking at this, can we do this? And they reached out to our insurance carriers. It sounds like there's potentially some additional insurance requirements, but they said yes, they've done it for other public agencies before.
You know, this looks like a really logical place. It looks like a great opportunity. I mean, there is congestion, but it's sort of at the center of the congestion, which means it seems to me that when crews get on the road and you go west or east, driving away from the congestion, at least until you default on the center. It seems like a great spot close to Highway 2. We just got to help our crews get up.
It is really an ideal location, being that close to Highway 2 again, the location between Snohomish and Monroe, and actually leaning towards Monroe and to the east, where our territory goes quite a bit out to the east.
Yeah.
And you're right there next to that main corridor. So even though there is traffic and there isn't congestion, you're still at the place that's going to get you to any of the locations that they're going to service the quickest way possible.
Yes. It is disappointing to see another general aviation field go away, but it seems like it's inevitable. A piece of property like this, where its location is, it's not going to remain an airfield.
Is an airfield something that could result in contaminated soil?
So we, back in August of 2022, went out and did some geotechnical borings and sampling, and we did come back with some possible positive hits for some contamination. We reached out to our consultants. They believe that they're actually probably false positives just because of the way that they take the samples quickly. So the next phase is to go out and put in some monitoring wells, which is sort of more of the gold standard, which will allow us to better identify if there is any contamination on the site.
A good thing.
Yes.
No, thank you.
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. Excellent job. Could we be up for a break?
Yeah, I was just trying to. Yeah, let's do it. Let's take I can't trust that clock. Let's take a 6-minute break and come back at the quarter after.
All right, it's 10:15, we're back. Hey, it's been a while since we've heard from Maureen, so how about you tell us about the City of Interurban River Regional Trail Easement Extension?
Got it. I'm Maureen Barnes, Manager of Real Estate Services, long time no see. The purpose of this presentation is to update the commission on our progress securing a new recreational trail easement and our current need for a short-term extension. It allows real estate services to sign off and execute the trail easement extension, which we're asking for 3 additional months to May 31st, 2024. And we're requesting board approval to move forward with the extension and vote via resolution to approve this request actually at the afternoon meeting. So again, a little bit of background. The original 25-year recreational trail easement was in force from August 1994, and the actual agreement expired in August of 2019. Over the last several months, we have worked closely with the City of Everett to get an updated recreational easement in place, and we've made substantial progress. We are asking for the 3-month extension. And I just want to say that of all of the municipalities, Everett has been great to continue signing an extension. So therefore, they've never been without an agreement for their portion of the trail. So that's been really fantastic. Anyway, the 3-month extension allows us to get through the legal review processes for the Everett City Council approval. Then we will return to commission for an actual public hearing and vote when we have the 25-year agreement nailed down. So our next steps, and this is in here, we are sending and voting on the same day due to the timeline. We did intend to get the new agreement signed prior to this expiration, which it does expire the 29th of February. However, the review slowed down and we just need a little bit more time. And I say just, and I do apologize for doing this. I think in our zest for thinking we would be coming and have all of them, unfortunately it didn't quite happen that way. So we will return this afternoon for the commissioners to vote on a resolution to extend. We will seek review and approval from the City of Everett via their City Council and staff. Once that has been completed, we'll come back here, have another presentation, ask for a public hearing to declare it surplus to the needs of the utility, and vote to complete the transaction. Any questions?
I have none.
I have none.
I have none. We've done this before. We know how to do it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Maureen.
Thanks.
Okay, next up is district cash and financial reserves, and it's Scott Jones. Good morning, Scott.
Morning, folks. I landed at SeaTac last night and checked my email. I had an email from someone on a question about this presentation, which reminded me that we're doing this presentation this morning. So lower your expectations now. I don't have Marine's polish. We'll work our way through this. So we talked, I guess, about a month ago in late January on kind of what happened from a district standpoint for operationally over MLK weekend. And that kind of pushed us in the direction of wanting to speed up some of the things we want to do on reserves. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today. The main point we're going to get through today is there's no official action on your part. I might look for a head nod on something we want to do here over the next couple of months. Then we're going to come back to you later this year with some probably deeper recommendations on some policy issues and things. So we're going to talk a little bit about the 24 impacts. We've got a couple of slides this afternoon associated with the rate presentation in the open meeting. We're probably going to talk a little bit more and maybe even a better summary of what happened both in January of 24 and even going back a couple of years. So I probably won't spend a whole lot of time on that because we'll have, I think, a better discussion about that later this afternoon. We'll give you an overview of the district reserves. I want to talk a little bit about how we're going to get in a better routine on updating you all on those things, and then some refresh and next steps. So again, no formal action today. You don't have anything on the agenda coming up. I do want to get a little bit of feedback on a couple of things though. January 24 impacts, we talked a lot about it in the last 30 days. Just a quick overview, and then we'll dive deeper this afternoon. But record loads. We have a basic economic supply and demand problem that we're wrestling with right now. And that combined with supply chain and inflation and some other things is going to be creating some, it's going to continue to create some challenges for us. So again, park that for just a second and we'll probably dive in a little bit more this afternoon on that. The reality of what happened in January, most immediate issue that we're wrestling with is about a $40 million hit a month. It was maybe 38 or 39 and change. It was about a 33 point something impact on purchase power plus a few other energy imbalance charges and things. So it's just a hair under 40 million. We estimated 40 and it came in pretty close to 38 or 39. That had a pretty big impact on day's cash on hand. I'm going to talk a little bit more in a second about how we track day's cash on hand. That's going to be an important part of something we want to talk a little bit about. I'm not worried about financial stability. The district is in a very good position from a financial health standpoint. I think I mentioned at the last meeting when I was up here that we recently had Standard & Poor's S&P came in January for view just to do a refresh on our credit rating, and they reaffirmed it as well. So not necessarily making that up from an optimism standpoint. We really do, I think, have a good financial stability footprint right now. And so I don't think we need to ring any alarm bells, but we do need to, you know, move forward with some caution. So later we're going to talk a little bit more about our proposal to increase the rate adjustment. You'll hear this afternoon kind of a walkthrough of how we got where we are. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that this afternoon. So let me do a reminder on reserves. One thing we've talked a little bit about is potentially doing this as a part of the budget process every year. And I think that'll get us in a better rhythm of reminding ourselves what our reserve position is. We come to you when we need to talk about reserves. We don't do it in a routine basis, and I think we can do a better job of that. And so I think one of the things we're hoping to do later this fall with the budget process is do our normal budget process, speed up the conversation about the rates and the classes and the recommendations there, and talk a little bit about what the reserve position is. So maybe we can get a better holistic view of all of those things in the fall, as opposed to just coming to you in a one-off. And I think that'll help all of our education as well. I mentioned this at the last meeting, but just to put it in print, there are kind of three buckets of reserves that I think about. There's our sort of checking account, there's our savings accounts, and there's a whole lot of other stuff that we kind of have to do. That other stuff is sinking reserves, project reserves, benefit reserves, debt service reserves. A lot of those are driven by the benefits we provide, or they're driven by the fact that we're into the market to borrow money. And so I want you to park that third category for a second. And today we're just going to really be talking about the operating and the contingency reserves. If you focus on those two, what we talk about a lot are the normal operating reserves, which includes a revenue fund and a debt management fund. We're going to be talking a bit about the debt management fund today. Normal operating reserves and then the contingency reserves, and that includes a self-insurance reserve and what Commissioner Logan and others have referred to as a rate stabilization component. I call it a contingency component. But, right, but either way, later this year, we're going to rally around what we're going to call those and put all of that to bed. So we'll rally around the terminology. But we're going to focus today on a recommendation on this revenue and debt management piece in the operating fund. And then we're also going to have a part two of looking deeper into the rate stabilization contingency reserve stuff for later this year. So part one of the suggestion today, we established what we call the debt management fund in 2019. I came at the very end of 2019. I came here and we had just recently put that fund in place. I won't go through all the history of that. It was a good recommendation at the time. I don't think we did the wrong thing. I think the times have changed a lot since then. One of the reasons why we put that debt management fund in place was because we were coming off of a time period where we had very healthy operating reserves. And so from a strategic standpoint, it's, you know, accumulating reserves is nice. The bankers love it. The rating agencies love it. Customers, maybe not so much. And so there's a sweet spot there in how much we want to have from an operating contingency reserve standpoint. We were looking at a potential AMI project. It was on the very front end of that. If you remember, that project was approved in 2020 in some stages and then moved forward after that. We parked $90 million into that fund. That was roughly equivalent to what we thought the AMI project was going to be. We wanted to put that kind of in our back pocket as a potential use. We placed funds. I came in the end of 19. We did a refinancing in 2020, and then into 2021. We did a new financing in 2021 and a new financing in 2022. Those financings, the one in 2021 was in the mid 1% range. We're not going to use cash, buckets of cash, if we can go out to the market and get 1.5% borrowing. So that was piece one. And then the following year, we did one that was under 4%. It was in the mid threes. Those are historically low interest rates for long-term bonds. So the combination of our credit rating times, which the rates had dipped, and us pouncing on those opportunities, we got some pretty cheap capital. Fast forward now, we're in a different place. We don't think we have an issue with access to capital right now. We've got some borrowings coming up over the next few years, but I don't see an issue with getting access to capital. Internally, we look at these funds differently. And that's just the way we look at it. We look at the operating revenue fund as the place where we track days cash on hand. And then we have the debt management fund. But because the way that debt management fund was created, it was not created as a restricted fund. It doesn't have restrictions around it. We can move money between those funds if we want to. Now, we've come to you and talked about that. We've only moved money once. We've told you about it, but we didn't need action on your part to do that. When you look at how the banks, rating agencies view these funds, because it's not a restricted fund, they look at it as an operating reserve. To them, it's just another checking account. And they look at it as, okay, well, you had a checking account and you opened up another checking account. So we see some value in collapsing those funds back together. And there's a few reasons for that. One is I'm a big fan of simplicity. We had good reasons in 2019 to pull it out just in case. We've got some good reasons to combine it back now. It syncs up the way we look at our operating reserves with the way the banks and rating agencies look at our reserves. And so putting them back together cleans that up just a little bit so that we can track it the way they do. One of the really critical parts of this, though, is we don't want to combine these and leave our day's cash on hand target at 120 days. We need to increase it. Now, the rating agencies would love us to have 220 days of cash on hand or 250 days of cash on hand. We don't need that much. But what we do think we'd like to have is at a minimum 150 days, probably more like 170 to 180 days. And so that piece, resetting the day's cash on hand, we need you to sign off on that. So what we'd like to do is collapse these two accounts back into one. We can do that on our own. We don't need your action for that. We'd like to so let you know that's what we'd like to do and see if you are okay with it. That's no action on your part. Part two of this is later this year, we'd like to come back with a recommendation on resetting a new cash, day's cash on hand. We're going to go out and look at some industry standards, and we'll talk to the rating agencies and see what their suggestions are. But we want to come back to you with a higher number. We think it's prudent. So that's part one. Part two of this is it's time for a refresh on our policies. We want to do this about every 5 years. This is going to be about year six, and so it's time. And really, we want to take a pretty holistic view of this. And so do we want to open up the contingency reserve policy and see what the criteria is? Do we want to open that up and see what the repayment plan criteria is? Do we want to see what amount is appropriate, which is something Commissioner Logan has asked us multiple times? And so we want to do all of that work over the next 6 or so months. That'll be us looking at our own internal perspective on it. We'll get the perspective of others as well. We'll get perspective from our peers. But we really want to come back later this year with a series of recommendations. One is going to be, here's our suggestion on a refresh for the policies themselves. Make sure we rally around what that language looks like. We're going to come back with a recommendation on our days cash on hand, 120 up to something, 150 to 180 probably. We're going to come back to you on recommendations for contingency reserves, that other $115 million or so sitting out there. How can we think about using it? Is the amount right? Do we want to fund more over a period of time in our budget forecast? And very importantly, coming out of what happened in January, do we want to use some of it before the end of the year? I don't want to be an alarmist about the need to tap that money yet. I do think that this incremental step we're taking on the rate increase, if you all agree, that is step one of a couple of steps. But we've got the balance of the year to see how the financial footprint plays out. And then going into the 2025 budget year, we'll know whether we need some of that money or not. I'm hoping not, but we had very aggressive cost containment steps last year, both in the beginning of 2023 and going into the 2024 budget. I really don't want to go through that process just yet again. And so we'd like to just see how the year plays out and then make some decisions in the fall on whether we want to use this or not. Those are the series of things we'd like to come back to you and talk through in August or September ahead of the budget process. So that's where we are. It's really two things. Part two of that is we'll come back later. We've got a laundry list of things for a good refresh. Do we want to use it or not? How are we going to use it? All of those things. Part one is we'd like to combine these two accounts back together and kind of get a reset on how we're looking at operating reserves. So that's where we are. Happy to answer any questions, field comments, whatever is on your mind.
Thank you. I don't doubt that we'll be all legal and appropriate, but I am concerned about transparency when we collapse the two funds. Mm-hmm. How can we ensure that we maintain for those people in our county? Mm-hmm. Our financial watcher, finance watchers, mm-hmm. financial nerds, whatever.
Right.
I do, you know, that's just a high priority, I think.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that people can find information when they want to.
Yeah. So one comment I make to that is I actually think this step makes that better, not worse. That's part of my challenge has been that for all the good reasons I think we had at the time, pull this out into that different checking account. I do think simplifying it and putting it back in one single operating reserve is cleaner to talk about. It's cleaner to communicate. It's cleaner to field questions. It's just the easier path. Right now, we're in kind of an interesting place where we look at this debt management fund in a different way than many people in the outside world look at it, because of the way it was set up. And so it's nice for us to look at it that way, but the reality is if we need that money to prop up operating reserves, we can just move it. It's literally like having two checking accounts, and you can move money from one to the other if you need to. And so I do think to that point, a big fan of simplicity. I really am. And John and I talk about this. I told John this when I was first hired. I don't want to do transactions. I don't want to enter into agreements and, you know, kinds of complicated financial transactions that we can't talk about in a simple way to the board and the community, right? And so if we can't articulate what our financial footprint is or the transactions we're entering into in a good, clear, concise way, I'm not going to be in favor of doing it. That's generally my posture. This is one of those places where I think we can clean up that simplicity. Say, we have one checking account, and it is an operating reserve. It has money flowing in and out of it. It's one place. Here's how we track it. Here's what it looks like. So my hope is that it's actually we're taking a step in the direction of simplicity. Thank you for that.
I look forward to the opportunity to discuss this more in depth in third quarter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before the proposed budget comes out, I guess.
Yeah, and the one thing I want to make clear is the first step we would like to take now is to collapse these two, the operating reserve revenue fund and the debt management fund. We have the ability to do that now, and we'd like to go ahead and do that. Then we'll start building the rest of this perspective on reserves, policies, cash on hand, strategy for contingency reserve, all those other things. But this first step, what I'm really asking is, you know, do you have any reservations or concerns on that first step? Again, we don't need action on your part, but I certainly would love a head nod of whether you feel like this makes logical sense to you.
No, I'm just listening.
Okay, good here. Hopefully, more questions. I have
some,
but.
No, I get it.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. I mean, it seems like it's an $80 million hiding hole for.
Yeah.
It looks like if I do back of the envelope, it's like 75 days cash on hand, probably at $80,000. So, I think it makes sense. I think it's more transparent because of that.
And Commissioner Logan, while you're continuing to think, let me make one quick comment on that. One thing I want people to know, we've been for the last several years, one day of cash on hand has been about the equivalent of $1 million, but that's not really what's happening. What's happening is as our cost footprint grows, the value of a day's cash on hand gets bigger. And so when I first got here, one day, you know, 120 days of cash on hand was about 115 to 120 million. Going into the next couple of years, 120 days of cash on hand is going to be more like 130 or 135 million. So that number does not grow, or it does grow. And we got accustomed in that little window of time to think a one for one, but it is increasing over time. And so you're right when you think about that $80 million in that debt management fund, it equates to about 70 to 75 days of cash on hand, depending on how far out you're looking.
I guess the other thing, and I'd like to see this when you come back to us, is to understand the size of the contingency relative to the number of days cash on hand.
Yes.
Obviously, if cash on hand was 200,
yes,
we wouldn't necessarily need as much contingency.
Correct.
As we would if it's 150. Mm-hmm.
Correct. It's an excellent point, and thank you.
Understand that.
Thank you for bringing that up. It's a great point, and you're absolutely right. I think if we move to, let's just say 180, if we move to 180 days cash on hand, then we might come back and say, well, you know what, we're pretty comfortable leaving the contingency reserve where it is. We think that it's somewhere in that neighborhood or less. The big factor there is the power supply risk. Now we've got materials price increase risk, we've got supply chain risk, we've got labor risk, all these other things. We'll talk about those more this afternoon. But power supply risk, as you have seen, will move the needle in an instant. And so, you know, in addition to all the other strategy things that John and others are trying to deal with from a power supply standpoint, the financial ramifications of those things are really big, and they can happen really quickly. John, you look like you were leaning in to say so, sorry.
The other thing I hope we talk about is the bandwidth. So obviously the 120 days isn't the floor to go below it now.
Yeah.
So what, in a new policy,
yes,
does board adopt a bandwidth?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the way we take care of that now, and I could see, this is a pretty typical process for most companies, is you can float below it, but you need to correct it over a period of time. Yeah. So it operates as a floor, but it's not a raise alarm bells the minute you go under it. It's a, you can be under it for a period of time, but you've got to have some plan to correct it over some period of time. Yeah. I think that's the way we can still accommodate that. But we definitely want to make sure that we all agree and understand what that criteria is. So sure, we can have 180 days. Can it drop below for 6 months or 3 months or 1 month or right. 1 week? And then how quickly do you need to correct it? Those are all very good questions that we want to put as a part of our final answers here.
There's one more thing, more questions?
I have no more, no. No. Not at this time. I don't want to take. I took us way off base at the last meeting. So.
No, I think this is great. I'm glad we're doing this.
Thank you all very much, and be patient.
Expectations low at the start of your presentation.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. That was very kind.
There's going to be a lot more to come.
I was
at the end, so
I was sitting back there beside Angela, yawning, and I was like, "Boy, this is late flight. That's my fault, not anybody else's." Thank you. So this afternoon, you'll see me again for a few slides as well to talk a little bit more about just setting the background, and then definitely prepare for August or September to come back for a more in-depth, deeper look at where we want to land on all these things. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott. Great job. Okay, last up for the morning is an update on our strategic plan. Quarterly update.
I'm short compared to other people, apparently. Good morning. Thank you, John. Thank you, commissioners. I'm Laura Lemke. I'm a senior program manager, and my area of responsibility is district strategic plan and performance planning metrics that go along with it. I'm here to do a quarterly update. I know it feels like I was just here a hot minute ago in December, and that's because we were a little bit delayed on getting here in 2023. So this is the first of two planned in-person updates this year. Prior presentations and conversations. I took off the laundry list of presentations that we did before we got to the approved plan, and we'll just track the conversations related to the approved plan moving forward. Today's purpose is our quarterly update. The intent moving forward, as we talked about at the last meeting, is we'll do two of these in person, one now, one for a Q2 review. We'll talk more about that at the end, and then written updates to you in the off quarters. Presentation is informational. I'm not looking for action from you on anything specific. That said, we are going to spend a fair amount of time talking about the KPIs that we've established, and I'm looking for you to tell me whether or not you're in agreement with those KPIs so that we can finalize them for quarterly updates and transparency to the public. For the benefit of anybody who's listening in or listens to the presentation, the recording later, these are our strategic plan elements. We have our purpose, our values, and our commitment. Those are our enduring fundamentals. We have our goal that we're driving toward under this strategic plan, which is to be the utility that delights our customers. They rave about us in a good way to their friends and family, continue to energize life in our communities. And underneath that, we have five strategic priorities supported by specific strategic objectives and named strategic initiatives. All of that's in the strategic plan. And there's a numbering system that I'll probably offhand make reference to. So if I use a number like 5.2A and you're like, I have no idea what that means, just please ask me. I'm not doing it intentionally. Since we last met, so in process before that, but then updating you since we last talked, we have established our top level key performance metrics, or at least identified a draft of what we think they will be. These are an outgrowth of looking at those strategic plan elements and figuring out what it would take for us to kind of track and report our progress against them in a holistic way. We had previously established KPIs for each one of the strategic objectives that the initiative lead teams and their ELT champions are tracking on a quarterly basis. This is that top level overall, how are we doing set of KPIs. As we, and stop me at any point here if you have questions, I'll try to remember.
Just ask, can you explain your acronyms?
Yes, I'm sorry.
PPIs.
PPI is a key performance indicator.
Okay, and PPI is?
That's just me talking too fast. It's always a KPI.
Oh, okay. Okay, I've got one.
That's on me. I'll try to, I've had a lot of coffee this morning. I started out my day by dropping my fresh latte on the sidewalk.
I don't listen fast.
No, I will slow it down. That's a good, good call. We're using our key performance indicators to give us a feel for how well we're doing on either moving the needle on things that we want to make progress towards accomplishing or maintaining our position in places where we think we're in a good place, but we want to make sure that we stay there and have a KPI that helps us keep track of whether or not that's happening. As I said, our key performance indicators relate to our values, anchors, and priorities. Several of them look kind of broadly across multiple priorities. That allows us to kind of see how they're interacting together as opposed to looking at each one of them in a silo. Some of these are best available measures. They might not be the ideal metric that we should be using or that we want to use long-term, but what we are striving to do is have something that we can use to measure our progress while we put some of those other KPIs in place, either by establishing a way to measure and track it, you know, continuing forward on strengthening existing data sources, et cetera. And then the waterfall is because theoretically your strategic KPIs at the top level are informed or cascade down to the metrics that we're using at the objective level, at the initiative level, and then also kind of filter out and are informed by those we're tracking on an operational level on a daily, weekly, monthly, or, you know, if your power supply, minute and hourly basis. We have established seven categories in conversation. Safety, safeguard what matters is our most important value. So we want to lean into safety. It's the most important metric that we track. We've looked at six other areas for now: electric system reliability, water system reliability, financial stability, customer experience, community engagement, and employee experience. My intent this morning is to show them to you as a whole and then just walk through each one of them at the level of detail that you want to make sure that we're all understand what the metrics mean, that we're in agreement that they're a good metric to get us started or a right metric long term. So this would be sort of our strategic plan dashboard, if you will. There are indicators on here that are either pink or green, depending on if we were above or below either a target, a goal, or the comparison that we're making to a prior period. There are a few of them that are light pink. There's was some debate here internally about if we're missing by just a tiny little bit, like ASAI, which is Average System Availability Index. It's the second one down under electric system reliability. We missed by 1/1000th of a percentage point. The nerd in me, the data nerd, says it can't be green when it's technically pink. And so we're using some lighter colors in a few places to indicate the fact that we've just barely missed or we've just barely gone above. And where it's gray, there's one of those under water, under operating ratio, and another for debt service coverage underneath electric. And that's really that, well, the measure has moved maybe in a direction that could have been pink, we're above our target or above our goal. And so it's really just that comparison to the last period.
I was very interested in all the priors and how much progress there has been. That was really impressive.
It's really fantastic when you take that step back and you compare yourself not only to what you know is happening right now, but where you've come from about tracking over time.
Commissioner, I have a comment. Now, this, there's been a lot of massaging in terms of how you're presenting this information. And as I was going through it, Commissioner Wolf talked about comparisons. And I have to tell you that from a customer perspective, there's a lot of information here, but you're laying it out in a way with definitions and everything that I really think this is a really good document.
Thank you.
Of the customer. If they are interested in it, it really tells a story. And I want to compliment your team. Everybody, I guess, that feeds into this monumental task, but kudos. I'm just so impressed. Okay, go on.
Thank you. I will take the compliment and pass it along to the people who helped develop it.
Yeah, I agree. This is a great format. I will say, if you just decrease your significant digits by one, I'll probably could be there.
Yes. And then the data nerd in me says, well, you know, perhaps.
I could have done it.
I'll keep us moving through, and I'll talk in a couple of places where the number of digits is perhaps surprising and whether or not we want or to make adjustments there. Mm-hmm. Okay. So safeguarding what matters. Again, safety to people and community is our most important value. The three metrics that we're tracking here, two of them showed up on the, actually all three of them, I think. Let me double check. Yeah, they're all three on the dashboard itself on the front page, is recordable incident rate. I know that Rob Beidler has been here, and I believe that that's a metric that you're familiar with. The second one is severity rating, which is really just a function of understanding while somebody was injured and it's a recordable incident and they sought medical treatment, how severe was that injury? So that's looking at the number of lost days per recordable injuries. And then the last one is preventable vehicle accidents. So I guess I'll pause. You can read and ask if you have questions about any of these three.
No, I have a question.
I actually had a question on the preventable vehicle accident. So we've only got 2 years of data here. We've got three for the other.
Yes.
It's not really clear the trend, right? Because we had the worst quarter and the best quarter in the same year.
Yes.
What are your thoughts? Is there a better way to present this information, or
so over
trend lines be included?
Over time, we will add more history to these graphs. The driving committee that meets on the first Tuesday of every month to review accidents and determine whether or not they were preventable has only been in place for the last 2 years. And so I don't want to say that the data prior to 2022 is not good, but it's different data. And so it's not a valid comparison.
It might really skew.
And so we will be extending that history and that trend line every quarter until they all come into alignment so that you have the same amount of history there. Okay. System reliability is up next. I feel like I'm stealing system planning and protection and everybody else's thunder by showing up to talk about these metrics. I am not the expert on these. We are tracking four on the electric side. Two of them, the bottom two, ASAI and SEMI-5, are metrics that have been appearing on your monthly dashboard that you get. So they've always been a last 12 months metric when you get that on a monthly basis. Here we're just looking at a quarterly basis over time, comparing to both Target on the ASAI side and simply a last 12 months or a prior 12 months for SEMI-5, because we don't have a Target established there at this point. Above that, so ASAI, the way you've been getting it is really, it's derived from our SAIDI, which is System Average Interruption Duration Index. Say that three times fast, which is basically the average minutes that an average customer was without power in a given period of time. And so the way you get to ASAI is you take the total minutes in the year, you subtract your SAIDI, and then you divide that by the total minutes in the year. Technically, that gets us to a target of 99.980%. And because we're data nerds in some places, we're taking that metric all the way out to the three decimal places just so that we're not giving ourselves credit for rounding. Otherwise, we'd argue that we should round it down. And then SAIFI is the System Average Interruption Frequency Index. The right-hand side, water system reliability, again, this is the same metric you've been getting on a monthly basis, just condensed down to look at it on a quarterly basis on a rolling 12 months. Questions about these five at all?
No.
Financial stability, if you ask me any questions about these, I'm going to turn around. Oh, they all ran away. Okay, and Angela's still here. I'm not answering questions about these. But we arrived at these three trying to find metrics that really assess the financial stability and health of the district that were potentially less volatile than some others, like percent dollars spent versus budget or days cash on hand, that really do show how we're tracking over time. So the three we landed on are current ratio, debt service coverage ratio, and operating ratio. And the operating ratio budget is functionally the target there, and we've given you some history just so that you can see how that's moving over time. That's one we have also historically benchmarked ourselves against other utilities on, and Sarah Bond and I are exploring some options for benchmarking there. Any other questions?
No, I'm just wondering, how are the requirements established? The electric utility requirement 1.00.
Requirements, you're talking about the requirements for current ratio and debt service coverage ratio?
Yes. Probably obvious, but.
So, Angela Johnston, Senior Manager, Finance and Seniors Management. So for the debt service coverage ratio, I'll speak to that really quickly. That's our bond covenants. Those are very defined by the agreement that we have with our bondholders. There's very little opportunity to move that, but thankfully we're doing very well in that area. The current ratio, that's kind of industry standard. I have to dig in to see how, you know, the metrics that we did use, but typically that current ratio is going to be along the utility industry, very similar, so we can be comparative. Quick and dirty.
I just didn't understand where that requirement comes from.
The current ratio is our standard. We're going to define it ourselves as to what the requirement would be, but typically that requirement would be in agreement with an industry standard of goodness.
That was my guess, but
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you. Thanks, Angela.
Let me just take a second to go back a slide. Thank you, Angela. On the reliability, we added SAIDI and SAIFI to the metrics, which were not as part of the overall district dashboard. And part of the reason, to Angela's point on the current ratio, those are the way the industry measures reliability. And we want to be able to, we set our goals, you know, not just based against our peers. There's also other factors, how many trees you have, the type of weather, so on and so forth. But that's a common measurement across our industry. And it gives us a way to track our performance to our peers.
So it's Katie too, right?
Yes, there is, which is basically the.
Not the value of the other.
Yeah, it's SAIDI times SAIFI.
SAIDI divided by.
Well, it took me 10 years.
I had an aha moment one meeting where they're all mathematically connected.
Yeah. I just finally decided to put the part in italics that reminds me what it is that the acronym means in English. okay. From a customer experiencing and community engagement standpoint, we're leveraging our JD Power metrics for this. I would consider these to be both a best available metric and a fantastic metric in terms of ability to benchmark ourselves.
JD Power is fantastic.
Wow. It's a good benchmarking opportunity to compare ourselves to our peers. The involvement in community metric is we would consider that a best available at the moment. Long term, as our strategic objective about getting clarity and clearly defining how we're engaging with our communities moves forward, we may define a different metric to substitute in for involvement in our community. These are our 2023 year-end score, which is basically your average of the four quarters. The comparison is to the 2022 overall score, 2021. Those two are our scores, and then the leader for each one of those scores. The leader in this instance happens to be Clark PUD for all three of them.
Surprise.
Shocking,
that'll,
right?
That'll be over with their 14% rating. I'm concerned about this one. I'm wondering if we have thoughts about it. We seem to be, in my mind, we seem to be doing more outreach than ever. And it's interesting to see that number dropping, not growing. We have thoughts.
The customer, the overall customer satisfaction index?
From 757 to 751 to 738.
So for context, the mid-size average, so the average for our segment has also gone down. I don't offhand remember exactly what that is, but we are not alone in that journey. Also, look to John, because you look like you want to jump in.
No, I think a big factor is the storm that we had last November. When you have a pretty impactful storm like that, it will absolutely resonate, and not just in reliability. It will resonate in each one of the factors and elements of
Does this include when we get comments from the public through our email or web text or whatever, and if there are customer complaints or negative, is all of that part of customer satisfaction?
It's all part of how we would evaluate customer satisfaction if we were doing our own scoring and evaluation. In this instance, JD Power does a quarterly survey of a certain number of our customers, and then they weight that survey back out to give us a score that's consistent with our peers. So the same things that you are hearing about in those comment cards and emails are the same things that would influence how customers are scoring us when they talk to JD Power. But this is not looking at our own internal data or those comment cards specifically.
Okay, so JD Powers is doing a lot of survey. Mm-hmm. And so that's okay.
Yep.
That explains.
They do. So we are part of what's called the West Midsize utility segment. There's 17 of us in that segment, so us plus 16 others. It includes utilities such as Seattle City Light, Tacoma Power, Clark, clearly,
sure.
And several others, both kind of right here in the Pacific Northwest and in the West. So Montana is included, Idaho Power is included, et cetera. And to John's point, part of the reason that we've added Sadie and Safey here and the longer duration is that customers are often not thinking about how well we've done in the last 3 to 6 months from a reliability standpoint. They're I want to say carrying a grudge. Their memories are long, right, in terms of what it feels like. And when JD Powers asks them, they're asking them to think back in time over the last year, over the last 6 months. And so some of the scores, other scores that we're looking at, are context for what might be driving JD Power scores.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense. The memories are long for negatives and short for positives.
When you have a bad experience, you tell 18 people, and when you have a good one, you tell
nobody.
So I anticipate that over the next over the course of this year, we may identify another metric for involvement in the community to either complement this one from JD Power or replace it, but we're not sure what that metric might be. Employee experience, this is another one where this is really a best available metric. So we're using voluntary employee turnover. So we categorize turnover into three buckets: you retired, you left voluntarily, or you left involuntarily. And of those three categories, the voluntary turnover is the piece that we're tracking as an employee experience metric. I've provided the other two as lines on the graph on the left-hand side for context for you, so you can see how the others are moving in concert. And then also the overall employee turnover is if you were to add those three lines together, and that's where we're able to get an external benchmark. And so it won't necessarily be on our scoreboard, but we'll provide it as context so we can see how we compare to peers in the industry. Those benchmarks are provided by Milliman. We get them annually. We'll probably get 2023 sometime mid-year this year. And there's a comparison there to Puget Sound overall, the Puget Sound public sector, and other Northwest utilities. There is active work happening under our Be an Employer of Choice objective to secure a consultant to help us with an annual employee experience survey. We've done some internally in the past few years, but to kind of get us on a path of doing that on a more regular basis so we would have metrics similar to what we have on the customer experience side. And we anticipate having that in place by the end of the year. It would either complement this metric with another one or potentially replace it.
I'm glad we have this one.
This was very interesting. Yeah, and I was getting this. This is low.
Yes,
this is really low.
actually, HR is going to hurt me if I don't remember to say it loud, is extraordinarily low compared to the two other industries, and historically we're doing quite well.
Where's the home has been, yeah.
Yeah. So this is my intentionally duplicated slide to just do a check-in on how we're feeling about these as the key metrics that we would be tracking for the overall strategic plan, and confirm if, whether or not you, or I guess ask whether or not you have any concerns about using these metrics moving forward.
I have no problem with using these metrics, even though we'll probably still have questions.
I learn something new about them every time somebody asks me a question, yeah, and I have to go ask the subject matter expert to explain it to me further, like I'm five.
Yeah.
No, gosh, I remember, I remember when you first came to us with this and the vision. And, you know, you're still rolling with it. I get more and more and more and better, but I see it now.
Moved from my brain to things that other people can experience.
This is good data. And so you said, in terms of where there hasn't been a lot of movement, is that then you make the determination as to, should we put something more into this to move it a fraction of a percent? Is that a judgment then that you make?
In terms of the work that we do to drive these metrics?
Yeah, just, well, in general.
Yeah, so the way
there's so little movement in a lot of these areas, so
and that's the piece where we get into exactly what I wanted to make sure I said to you as part of this wrap up of the KPI section, is that strategic key performance indicators tend to move slowly over time.
Yeah.
They move incrementally. They give you a feel for how you're doing.
Yeah.
Overall, either maintaining a position or capturing a new position. If they're moving quickly, it either means we probably have the wrong metric or something extraordinary is happening, like the Martin Luther King weekend financial impacts. That said, the way that we would use them is to, if they're green and they're going in the right direction, we're above a target, we're making progress, as long as in the green, we can decide whether or not we're happy with the speed at which we're moving, depending on if it's a maintain or a push. Yeah. Sounds like John.
Oh, okay.
If metrics are living in the light green, the light pink, or the pink, we would make decisions about whether or not we need to reevaluate the work that we're doing to move those metrics or do new and different things. Each one of these is supported by more detailed, more in the weeds metrics at the objective and the initiative level that really gives the people that are working on that a feel for what's making this number move or not move.
Yeah.
So for example, if we're tracking SADE here at the highest level, or we are tracking SADE here at the highest level, so it's a power outage. At the objective level, we've got metrics around what's driving those outages. Are they preventable or non-preventable? Are they tree or not tree? And then down at the initiative level, we might have metrics that look specifically at actions we're taking around, you know, 20 worst circuits and that type of thing, and understanding whether or not the work that we're doing there is the right work. And that cascade effect exists for most of these. So I'm also the person behind the curtain on the monthly metrics dashboard that you get. We've been having an internal conversation that we've moved fairly far along on this idea of taking, we were using the same metrics internally and thinking about which of those are actually strategic metrics and which ones are actually operational metrics. And we've been internally dividing that into two different sets of dashboards. So we're looking at, say, year-to-date SADE from an operational standpoint, while we're looking at a rolling 12 months from a strategic standpoint. So as part of that effort, I anticipate changing the monthly metrics that you're getting to be more operational in nature. We are, I don't know if we're alpha or beta on the internal version of the metrics, but we're expecting to work through that. And I anticipate that you'll see a change in that monthly dashboard, either when we report February to you in March or when we report March to you in April, to just sort of delineate, these are the operational ones that give you a feel for the pulse of the business, where we're on track and off track, and where we might need to make adjustments, versus the strategic, you know, move slowly over time metrics. I guess maybe ask if there's, if you have any concerns about some changes to that.
A month goes so fast.
Yes.
Have you thought about doing it every other month? Or if you really need and want to do it monthly?
In terms of reporting to you?
Well, just in your own.
So the dashboard, so we're tracking the these strategic key performance indicators we'll be looking at and reporting to you quarterly, and we look at them as part of the quarterly review process. We have operational metrics that we're looking at on a weekly and a monthly basis that we'll be providing you a subset of monthly that will replace the existing monthly dashboard that you're getting. It doesn't take any extra work on our part because all of that reporting is automated at this point. So we're simply producing it. I'm simply producing a PDF that comes to you when the month is closed and we're satisfied that the metrics are stable.
Did the board identify quarterly?
Or
when you come back, when these come quarterly, this presentation.
So our management system internally is a quarterly review. And so in, when I was here in December, we talked about, you expressed a preference that quarterly in front of you was too frequent. And so we talked about doing this twice a year. So once now and once at the end of Q2. And then we'll give you a quarter, a written report in the interim quarter. So you would get something similar to this just as a PDF as part of your board packet at the end of Q1.
Yeah, that, but this is twice a year, right?
Yeah, me standing here talking to you is twice a year.
Okay, yeah. Because strategically, for me, I see little value. Okay, I misunderstood.
No, it's a great clarifying question. It's my, that'll be my last slide.
Yeah, I think that these are the exact right metrics. I'm really impressed. I'm a data-driven person, and this is really wonderful data. It'd be interesting to see as we go down the road if customer experience legs or leads the electrical system reliability, we can actually graph those up and see if there's an indicator.
Hillary Olson, who is the program manager over customer experience, is working through the process of, so JD Power would be considered a lagging indicator,
right?
Because we're always asking them to look backwards.
Yeah.
And so could we establish some leading indicators that we could then use to understand a quicker rhythm what might be driving JD Power score specifically?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that I don't want people to feel that are working hard improve our customer experience, and somehow they're failing because the number's going down, because the number's going down because, you know, of outage situations.
Yeah,
our customer service could be just bailing it.
There's a lot of initiatives that do impact customer experience that don't show up in the JD Powers and or JD Powers. Just keep in mind, it's a perception survey.
Yeah, yeah.
So you could have, you know, what you think is a customer, an extended outage, and you're going to grade us on how we engage in the community, our customer service, all of those different elements of that come with the JD Power are going to get a little bit tarnished because of that bad experience.
Mm-hmm.
We just use that. Again, it's back to, it's an industry measuring tool for customer satisfaction. It's just one of the tools that we use, and it allows us to benchmark. You know, we cast Clark as our arch nemesis because they continue to be at the 800 or above where we are striving to be.
How are they getting there?
Well, we'll see how that lands, because there are two things, storms and rate increases that have the biggest impact and usually a lagging impact or residual impact on JD Power scores. But one interesting, and I think we've talked about this before, it's actually less on the reliability part of the JD Power survey. It's less about actual reliability. We get more points and more customer satisfaction during through our outage communication and outage notification. And communicating to our customers early and often, giving them updates on what the cause is, ETRs, those are the real satisfiers. And that those are the things that we will see reflected through the survey longer term.
And JD Power is pretty exhaustive, similar to our own customer satisfaction survey, in that I don't know how many questions they ask, but something in the neighborhood of 45 or 50 questions of people. And so we do have the ability to dive down underneath that overall satisfaction score to understand what's driving that number. And that's an effort that Hillary and several others undertake on our behalf every quarter. I'm going to speak very briefly about 2023 key achievements related to the strategic plan. That's mostly not my work. I'm just representing and wrapping it up for you here. This list, I believe that there were presentations to the board on all of them except for the Enterprise Project Governance Board. You've seen the results of this work. You understand the impacts that it's having and where it's going. This is a subset of what's happening in relation to the strategic plan, but if I put it all here, you would have a report that's 60 pages long in exhaustive detail that is probably more information than you want. For each one of the, so I guess I will pause and ask if you have any questions about any of these achievements that I can either answer or get someone to come bring you back an answer on.
Okay, so I think I recall that the EPGB, Enterprise Project Governance Board, was formed about a year ago, maybe?
The intent was identified as part of the strategic plan, and I think that they officially became the EPGB in Q3 last year.
Right, and how's that working?
It's fabulous, actually.
Is the governance board finding that everything is working, flowing along? I know it's a way of coordinating everything, all of the projects.
So I don't want to speak for them, and I'm sure that they will be here at some point, but from my seat on the Enterprise Project Governance Board, it feels like all of the pieces are coming together in terms of a framework for how to score projects and understand how they relate to each other for prioritization, as well as the process and the forms and the review process.
Right.
To stand all that up, there's a monthly rhythm and cadence to that. I missed it last week because I was homesick and couldn't come, but there did the first round of kind of a big room prioritization effort for 2024 projects in preparation for prioritizing 2025 going into budget planning. So there's a lot of work happening there on the EPGB side, led by Doris Payne and Serena Fothergill, and then also integration into budget planning and other pieces.
Well, at the time I thought, this is great. I mean, we really need some way to coordinate all of these many projects and initiatives and all of that. So I'm just wondering, how you think it's flowing.
The team has just done a fabulous job of getting the process stood up. I mean, we are in a much, much better place now than we were a year ago, that we were even six months ago. Again, it's just a huge kudos to the team. They've got process in place, getting folks engaged, and it will help us. One, it'll help us just execute on projects more effectively, be able to budget more effectively, but also relieve some anxiety where everybody's on the same sheet of music as to what's prioritized, where we're gonna dedicate resources, and the timing of the projects. So yeah, excellent work by the team. We're in a great place.
So it's doing good things for us.
And we'll continue. The benefits are really, are going to come out in the future.
Well, I'm in the front row seat as a fan for the work that the folks are doing. It is critical. And we will reap benefits over time.
As we go along, more people are engaged, we do get into a natural rhythm, it becomes part of how we do work and just our DNA and part of the culture. And that's what's really important.
Well, the labor allocation, you're not knocking on IT's door through three projects.
We're still knocking on their door with three projects. We're just prioritizing them.
Well, I know prioritization, but that you have to do what you're going to be doing in order to get there.
Yes.
Do you think the information about the EPGB might be something that the communications department might want to share in some way with the public to know that It's internal, but to me, what it says is we are really watching out for every aspect of our utility. And we have people who are, I don't know, I'm just tossing it out. As a member of the community, I would find that very impressive.
I believe it would be interesting, and I will ask if they're sitting right here.
It's not a request.
Aaron can.
I don't. It's not a request. It's just a question. I think, is that something you might want to think about?
So it seems like the EPGB.
Say that three times fast.
Is a, you know, it's a perfect way to make a strategic plan come alive for all women in the district to understand where we put our resources, where we don't put our resources. Absolutely.
And sequencing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work that they're doing to have you stand that up.
IT is more and more. Yeah. All right.
So the following five slides, I'm not going to speak to unless you have specific questions, but this is the format that the written quarterly report would take to you in terms of going objective by objective with key achievements and activities for the given quarter. With a wrap up at the end of the year, and then a reference to the related commission presentations, which is partially for your benefit if you want to go back and look deeper, but also for the benefit of the public that might be reviewing these reports. So there's one for each one of our priorities. I'll pause here because I always grin every time I see the energy block party and the run for warmth photos. And then also for the work that we're doing on sustainability through environmental services and other teams. My wrap up, looking forward to Commissioner Olson's question earlier, I will try not to be, oh, sorry.
On page 20, I just wanted to highlight for me how 5.2 evolve workforce skills and capabilities. Again, I'm in the front row of the theater, and it is critical. This is so critical to the success of this organization. And you get to do it.
And I apologize because I just skipped through these. Were there questions on any of the other pages?
That's one I wanted to mention.
Okay. Go on. So looking forward, recognizing that, well, I'm fabulous. You don't want to see me every quarter per report. That sounds exactly the same. Ongoing and upcoming work. So as we just talked about with all the work with the EPGB is doing, there's also continued integration and collaboration on how we bring all of these pieces together from a strategic plan, initiative action plan, the Enterprise Project Governance Board perspective, budget and financial planning, near and long term. And then as well, super excited that we have an enterprise risk manager on board starting last Friday. So as we stand up that enterprise risk management program, how does that integrate into these as well? So that work is all happening behind the scenes. You'll probably see parts and pieces of it in presentations to bring you along on those journeys. Specific to the strategic plan, we're continuing to do some refinement on performance metrics and dashboards, as we just talked about, including reporting to you. We're monitoring the world to see if we need to make adjustments to the strategic plan, to the activities that are going underneath that. Part of that is the quarterly review process that the ELT and the initiative leads and objective champions undertake, where we look at those, we take them in context of the wider world. So from a reporting to you, it would be a written report for Q1 in the May 21st meeting packet. It's basically, we do this anyways, and then we take a subset of it and share it with you, and it would include the KPIs. On August 20th, we would do a year-to-date presentation to just have an opportunity to touch base on those KPIs, hit some key highlights about work that's going on, a written report for Q3 in November, and then I'm assuming sometime in February 2025 to do this kind of touch for 2024 as a whole. This is what I understood we were going to do coming out of our December meeting, and it is my recommendation to you is that while the world changes slowly on this, keeping our fingers on the pulse of what's happening can help us have an indicator of if and when it's time to revisit the strategic plan and do a refresh before 2027. Questions? Concerns or comments?
No, just an observation, commissioners. That November written report, I think it'll be very valuable to us as we go into first part of the following year in terms of evaluation.
And the, you know, the budget. So I mean, that's the other thing that's really excited about how we're doing this. The budget is, comes out of this work.
It has a direct tie to the budgeting process.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Is there anything else for me, John?
That should do it.
Okay. It is now 11:25 a.m. The board will recess into executive session to discuss current or potential litigation under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meeting Act. It's anticipated the executive session will last approximately 35 minutes. I can't read the time, which will put us and conclude at, we'll conclude at 11:50. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m.